it's with great pleasure that Ruth is here tonight. It's great pleasure to introduce her. She's gone to just about the ends of the earth to get here. She started to leave for San Jose yesterday in the morning, and she finally got here this afternoon. Thank you, American Airlines pilot. She's been to two or three different cities, a hotel that they put her in with a man, and she said that's not going to work, and so they had her get a cab, and she went to a different hotel, and then they flew her into Los Angeles this morning and then here this afternoon. I found Ruth, like I think many of you did, at the San Diego Convention in 1995. For me, it was a magical night. If for those that weren't there, I'd like to just give you a capsule of what it was like. There was a very much a big to-do about the old-timers meeting that night, and that they made a really big deal about the old-timers were only going to speak for a very short period, and they would be gonged if they went over that. And they had a big gong that they would pound. And the names were picked out of a hat. The old-timers put their names in a hat that chose to speak. And Ruth's name was chosen, and she got up on the stage, and she started talking, and the place went just with mesmerized quiet. I mean, you could hear a pin drop in the stadium with 60,000 people. And we didn't want her to leave, and they kept gonging her. And what did we do? Ruth! Then I had the pleasure of moving to New Jersey for a year and a half, and there's a wonderful women's meeting in Red Bank, New Jersey, that Ruth was the luncheon speaker there one day. I just happened to go to that meeting, and they had a luncheon once a year, and Ruth was the speaker, and I got to hear her there also. And I think it's very important for us to hear the oral history of Alcoholics Anonymous, and Ruth is going to share that with us tonight.
Well, hello, everyone. My name is Ruth, and I'm an alcoholic. And you have given me such a boost. You see, I had it all planned. I was a speaker at the banquet. I was going to have a lovely outfit. It's in my bag someplace. Well, this is what you get. Anyway, it's wonderful to be here. I've been at many of the women's conventions, and you see, when I came in, I was trying to get a woman for a sponsor. And I went to many women who said to her, "Are you a member of this group?" And she would say, "Oh, no, I'm writing a thesis on alcoholism." We had someone in the family, and I'm here investigating. But I had the big book. Thank God. Well, I can start from the beginning, because you want to know about the beginning. My first meeting was on April 14th of 1948. You don't applaud me, because it was God who did it. Anyway, to begin in the beginning, I lived in the Bronx, New York. If you had come to my apartment door, I would probably answer the door in a house dress and an apron. And in one apron pocket, I had my 54-day rosary novena booklet and my rosary. And in the other pocket, I had a shot glass. I was praying like mad. And I was drinking like mad, too. Now, behind me, there would have been two little boys probably playing on the floor. And in the bedroom, there was an infant, brand new. But anyway, this was my story. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I was praying a lot. But I went to confession on this occasion. In fact, it was the occasion when the baby was going to be baptized, and my oldest son was going to receive his first communion. They were 6 and 4, so they told me. By this time, my son girl had heard me speak, and they corrected me on a few things. He used to say they were 7 and 5, but you see, their birthday was November. So they were not yet, but they were 4 and 6. Anyway, I'm getting ahead of my story. I did go to confession, which I generally did. I had that poor priest crazy because I didn't know what was wrong with me, you know. But on this occasion, I said to him, Father, you know, I've had a series. I had 3 full-term pregnancies that wound up with stillbirth. And so, we know now what a trauma that was. But in those days, they'd say things to me like, oh, fuck up, you know. Get on with your life, you know. But it was a terrible thing. So when this baby was born, it was wonderful. He was the biggest baby I ever had. And we had been praying to St. Anthony. He said we'd name a girl Antoinette. He never got a girl. But if it were a boy, we'd call him Anthony. So when Tony was born, I was in the hospital, I guess, about a week those days. And when I came home, the house was full of relatives and friends. They were all so happy, you know, that I had had a well baby. And my mother had pulled out this long table I had, and the neighbors and everybody were all seated around this long table, and all drinking, you know, celebrating the baby birth. And I had to show them Tony and then put him to bed, you know. But anyway, one of my friends came in and put a bottle in front of me of Gus Gordon sherry. And my mother was down the other end, and I'm at the head of the table, and she called out, she said, Ruth, that's good. That makes milk. Now, that was the good housekeeping seal of approval. So I had not been drinking prior to that. In fact, I thought, you know, that I would, in fact, I thought I'd give up drinking many, many times. But, well, this makes milk, so I opened the bottle and had a glass. And everyone continued to celebrate. They all stayed and stayed. And before the night was over, I had finished the bottle. Well, the worst thing that happened was Tony slept for 2 days. But we did survive. So here I'm telling you about going to confession to Father Murray, my usual confessor, and telling him, I said, you know, Father, I secretly thought that when I had a well baby, this crazy drinking would stop. In fact, I think I got it from my mother and my sisters. They'd say to me, good Lord, all she has is maternity clothes. Of course, she'd never get a new dress. And they sort of excused my drinking. You know how enablers are. But anyway,
In my mind, I thought, well, when I get a baby, that will be wonderful. So I told the priest this, and then he said to me, are you one of that kind of person who can't take one drink and stop? And I said, oh, no, I often have only one drink. He said, at the times that we went to visit my in-laws, my father-in-law served one drink all night. Oh. Misery. Well, I thought of the times I lived in the Bronx on the hill, and the only place to shop was in the supermarkets down the hill. And I always paid 35 cents for one Manhattan to get me up the hill with the packages. So when I answered him, I said, yes, I often have only one drink. So then he said to me, well, would you make me a promise that you won't take another drink? I said, no, Father, I know. I'm not promising you. He said, I can't promise my mother that or my husband that. He said, why not? I said, well, if I break a promise, I'm not coming back to confession. I'm not worth saving. So he said to me, you know, there's a man in Our Lady of Mercy parish who I think could help you. Now, he had heard about this fellow who had stopped drinking. Alcoholics Anonymous, but he didn't explain that to me. I could picture another priest in a bright light. Here it was a dark confessional, and I didn't mind telling people how I drank. I said to him, well, Father, I'll do as you told me in the past. I'll control my drinking. Tomorrow we're having the christening and party for my First Communion, the way we'll have a big crowd, and I'll have to drink tomorrow. But after that, I will cut down. So he said to me, well, if you stray bad, he said, if you find you can't control this drinking, will you see about the man and Our Lady of Mercy? So I said, yes, I'll do that. So he gave me absolution, and off I went. Feeling good, and then I told my husband, I said, John, I'm going to stop drinking. And my husband, he said, oh, thank God. He was so delighted, and I said to him, what did you get for the party tomorrow? He said, I got a half a keg of beer. He said, oh, I hate to quit on beer. I can't even hold it. Thank you. But anyway, he went out. He said to me, what would you like? And I said, Canadian Club. He said, okay. The poor guy was ready for bed, but he got dressed and went out and bought Canadian Club for the party. And we had his relatives from Jersey City and my relatives from Pennsylvania and Bayonne, New Jersey. We had a big crowd, and we had a wonderful party. I noticed that most of them were taken to that Canadian Club, and this keg, which was in a dinette, I called it, was up on a, you know, an upside-down stool or something. And there it stood, and I went in and opened the window on it, and I thought, this would be great for breakfast. The beer. But anyway, I had all full intentions, you know, of quitting drinking. But somehow I thought beer was food. Anyway. Anyway, the day went on, and it was a big success. And the next morning, I'm giving John his breakfast, and we're sitting at the kitchen table, and he's complimenting me. He said, hon, you were a wonderful hostess. We had a great party, and you drank like a lady, which is impossible, by the way.
Anyway, I loved it, you know.
And then the knock came at the door, and it was the fellow coming for the keg. What a dirty trick. There he came in. My husband took him in to where it was standing. He put it on his shoulder, and off he went down the stairs, and my husband after him. My husband went to work. I couldn't holler. That's my breakfast. They went. So, would you believe I took the dregs, you know, that were landed in the basin there, this miserable thing, and I strained it into a glass, and I drank that miserable stuff. And I was the kind of person who wouldn't drink out of a cracked cup or wouldn't have certain silverware. Oh, I was so particular, except when it came to drinking. Anyway, that was the way I started on this campaign to stop that drinking. And then I remember a lot of things happened. I often tell about this one story, and now it's coming back to me. People remember when I told these stories long ago. As a matter of fact, when my second husband and I went to Ireland on a trip, he learned the word to call me. What they call a storyteller in Ireland is a shamaki, and that's what he named me, because I've had a million stories. But anyway, now what was told? In 1947, there was a terrific blizzard in New York. So much so that everything was shut down. It started on Christmas afternoon, and I had had, I used to think it was a couple of months without drinking, but it was just a few weeks that I hadn't had a drink. But I got, you know, got the toys for the kids, everything was going along great, and we got the Christmas tree and just had a lovely party. And on Christmas Day, we had a good dinner, and then my husband said to me, "Well, you did a great job. What a great Christmas. What would you like?" He said, "What would you like a drink? What would you like?" So I said, "Well, I know you're a rotten bartender, but you can make Manhattans if you would." So he went to the kitchen and got us some Manhattans, and here he brought me in the nice long-stemmed glass, you know. And he said, "Here you are, hon," not knowing that that was the trigger on the gun for me, you know, the first drink. We didn't know, you know. But anyway, I enjoyed it. And then his firm called. This blizzard lasted, and he was in the comptroller's office, and they were having the fiscal year was ending. He had to go downtown to a hotel, and they sent some kind of vehicle to get him through the snow and down to the Roosevelt Hotel, I think it was. But anyway, he was gone. And there under the tree were all these beautiful boxes that he had gotten from fellow, you know, and beautifully wrapped bottles of booze. And I had had that first Manhattan, you know, so I just thought I'd like to sample some of these. So, since we were snowed in for so long, you know, and the kids, they had their toys and everything, you know, it was a great time. I think I did a little dance when it happened. But when we came up to, well, even for New Year's Eve, he came home for just the night because our apartment house always had a New Year's Eve party. We visited each other's apartments. It was a great way. Anyway, and then he went back again. So about the 3rd or 4th of January is what I'm going to tell you about. I had to go to the store. So I asked a neighbor to come in and stay with the kids, so that I could go to the neighboring Safeway. And this gal came in, and I remember feeling in the bag yet, you know, because
For one thing, I remember I had a turban on. I didn't wear them unless you couldn't comb the hair, you know. Twisted it around. And I also had something that I loved. My sister-in-law had moved to Florida, and she lent me her winter clothes. And she had left me a delightful raccoon coat. It was completely lined with satin, you know, right down to the sleeves and everything. And it had a pocket in it. Inside, just held a pint. It was a great coat. So off I went to the supermarket, and I'm taking things off the shelves and putting them into the basket. I came to a can of shelled walnuts, and I still love nuts today. I thought, gee, it'd be nice to have, but it was, I think, 79 cents, and I thought, that's too dear. But I took the can and put it in the sleeve of the fur coat. And I, you know, I woke up for a minute. It was a cold can. Then I kept going around the store and filled up the basket, and I got up to the counter, you know, to check out, and the fellow said to me, "The manager would like to see you in the back of the store." Well, when I had those drinks in me, I would have faced anyone. So I faced that smiling Irishman, but he wasn't smiling. He said to me, "Where's the nuts?" Well, at that, I really pulled a faux pas. I reached in here instead, and I came out with a quarter of a pound of butter.
Oh, my God.
That was a complete surprise, you see. But I said to him, "I'll pay you for these items, but I don't want either of them. That butter is all melted." He looked at me and said, "I can't understand it. I can't understand it." I said to him, "You never in a million years would." And I turned on my heel and got out of that store like a flash, thinking, "Oh, dear, I'll never tell anybody about this." But anyway, when I got home, I dismissed my neighbor and went right to the closet where the booze was hidden and took a big, long drink to forget that ever happened. But anyway, then, as I told you, I heard about this person from Our Lady of Mercy, and one night I woke up at my kitchen table, and I had had my head down on my hands. I knew I had been out of it. And I thought, my goodness, what day is it? And I looked at the clock first, and it was 8 o'clock, and it was a Thursday. I thought, oh, thank goodness, it's John's bowling night. He won't be home until 10 or 11, and I have some time to compose myself. Next, I ran into the boys' bedroom, and they were playing in their pajamas, and then into the baby's room, and he was asleep. But I didn't even say, "Thank you, God, for looking after my kids," you know. I was so wrapped up in myself. I thought, what happened to me today? I didn't intend to drink today, and I was doing pretty good, I thought. I thought, my goodness, I didn't even have any money. Well, then I looked under the kitchen sink, and I saw that I had this half gallon of Mission Bell wine, and it was empty. And I knew from the way I felt, it must be inside me. And that, I had only had that wine because my husband had me join a little neighborhood circle where we went to each other's homes, and we served wine coolies. But I had my own stash in the cupboard when I was making those coolers. I was having my favorite up here. And so that wine could have lasted forever the way I felt about it. But here I was. I said to myself, drinking this on a day I didn't intend to drink. Now I better see about that priest in Our Lady of Mercy, who I thought he meant. So I went to the telephone, and I dialed the number of the rectory, and I got a lady's voice on the other end of the wire, so I said to her in my usual fashion, "I have a problem. My husband drinks very heavily." "I understand you have a priest up there who can help him." So she said, "Not that I know of, but I'll let you speak to the pastor." Now, that pastor was well known in AA circles later because he had been in Fordham Hospital. He had an appendectomy, and he was put in the room with an old friend of mine who was a New York detective. And they're writing things about him now. He was a great guy. His name was Joe Hennessy. I can blow his anonymity because all my old friends are dead. Lord have mercy on them all. They're cured. But anyway, this priest had been in the room with him, and he said to him, "Who the devil are you? Are you related to the governor or the mayor? I never saw anybody get so much company." All men coming to see Joe, you know. So he said, "No, Father, I'm in AA." Now, well, you can imagine, for the next 10 days or so that he was recuperating, he was bombarded with stories of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so he said to them when he was leaving the hospital, "I want you fellows to meet in my school hall." Now, that was in 1946. And I'm calling him, telling him about my husband in 48. But anyway, he was well known, and I'm saying to him, "I have this terrible husband." And he said, "No, we have no priest like that. We have a non-religious organization, and they meet in our school hall every Wednesday." He said, "Now you can bring your husband up, but if it's yourself, why don't you come?" And so it was that Thursday I learned about him, and I made up my mind to go to that meeting. Anyway, the one thing I regretted afterward, I had a wonderful next-door neighbor, and she and I used to go shopping together and everything, and on one occasion she caught me drinking. And I'll tell you the story, because those days, maybe some of you were that old, we used to get these gifts of a cocktail shaker and 2 glasses. Mine said "me and you" on the glasses, but who cared about the glasses? I made my drinks in the shaker. When John would leave for work in the morning, I'd just squeeze a whole lemon into the shaker, then take the sugar bowl, dump some in, then some cubes, and then the bottle. And I'd have a drink for the day. Anyway, my neighbor came in one day, and the way she described it, she said, "I'm walking around with this shaker full of gook and drinking and crying." She said, "I don't mind if the gal is having a drink and having a good time, but you were crying your eyes out." So I told her that I planned to go to this meeting, not knowing it was Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know what it was. But anyway, every time she saw me that week, she'd be saying, "Are you going to that?" Oh, God. Who needs this, you know? But anyway, comes the day, and my mother had her own apartment in the Bronx, and I called her and said, "Mom, would you come up and mind the kids, because today is the day I'm going to that meeting." So she said, "Will there be any fireworks, Ruth?" And I said, "No, he isn't even speaking to me, Mom, and I don't know if he's coming home." So she said, "All right, I'll be there." So she came up to mind the children, and I got our dinner ready, and we had this dinette, and we all went in and into the dinette and had our dinner. What a dinner that was. My husband came home, but you see, my husband felt no wonder she drinks. This one spoiled her all her life, see? And my mother thought, no wonder the poor kid drinks, married to this guy. They were blaming each other for my drinking, you know. But so there wasn't much conversation between those two. And I was always in the doghouse, so they weren't talking to me. So we all spoke to the children. Well, we would say things like, John, pass the potatoes to your father. And Frank, you moved that over, you know. What a terrible way to live. But in the course of this meal, I said, oh, it's getting late, and I pushed my chair back, and I left to go into the bathroom to get ready for this meeting I was going to. So I heard my husband say to my mom, where does she think she's going? And my mother said, she's going to Our Lady of Mercy to see about her drinking. Whispered. Well, he made a remark like, she better come back here in one piece or something, you know. And I continued because the rest of the beer was in the bathroom. I had just bought a few bottles of beer that day, and I just left the last of it in the bathroom, getting ready to go to the meeting. I couldn't find a pair of stockings without rips in them, but I pulled on a pair of boots. Not the kind, not the stylish kind, but the kind you have for ice and snow. I pulled them on, and I got dressed in Winnie's clothes, you know, my sister-in-law. The trouble is, Winnie was 5'9" in her stocking feet. I still don't know how I wore her underwear. But I did. Anyway, in that stylish fashion, I left the house and went up and sat in the back of this school hall while people passed. They had told me that the meeting started at 8 o'clock or something like that. It really didn't start until about 9. But I'm sitting in the back of the hall and, would you believe, criticizing everybody I saw. One gal who walked in, I thought, wow, good drink would kill that thing. And the next one was all dressed up, and I thought, oh, too rich for my blood. Boy, would you get a look at me? At any rate, no one came over to me, but on the other side of the hall, a man came in, and he had a similar coat. His coat swept the ground, too. And he had pulled out the teeth that had gold in them that day and sold them for booze, you know. So he didn't look too great, and neither did I. But here I am in the back, and a dog came over and sat at my feet. That dog used to attend those meetings regularly. But I think he might have found, you know, a neighbor on my boots or something. But I sat there, and no one came to speak to me. But finally, everybody moved up toward the front, and then I saw this dark red curtain on the school auditorium, you know, on the stage. And there were things like, but for the grace of God, first things first, our slogans were hung on that red curtain. So that didn't mean anything to me. There was a table, and I could see something. I thought it was a box of checks on the table. It was actually our big book, but the first edition had a crazy paper cover. It looked like checkers, you know. like that cereal. But anyway, along with that, there was a box, which I found out later, we all put our change into. Everybody rode subways and buses in the Bronx, and the L train, my favorite. And they put their extra change into that box, and that was saved because we always gave Bill and Lois Wilson a Christmas present. So that first year that I was in 1948, we gave them outdoor furniture for their house in Bedford Hills. They had moved, you know, from Clinton Street, and they moved up there. So they invited us all to sit on this outdoor furniture. The trouble was, that was wartime, and that was made of wood, the furniture that we gave them. There's a film of Bill and Lois sitting at our furniture in their yard. But I visited Stepping Stones just a few years ago, and I had everybody looking for our outdoor furniture. Now, they were looking for wrought iron and plastic the way it is now, but they couldn't find it. When I spoke at a meeting up in New York State, a couple in the first row held up their hands and they said, "It's on the porch." It wasn't. It wasn't. I sat on the porch. It was long gone. It's been 50 years and more, thank God. But anyway, this first meeting of mine, I was waiting to see what happened, you know. And then the man got up and he said, "My name is so-and-so, and I am an alcoholic." Well, light dawned. This was Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had read about it in the papers and everything. And so I was intrigued. Then he said, "If anyone here is interested in this new program." Now, it wasn't very new, but there were not many people then. He said, "You may speak to the gentleman with the white carnations in their lapels." This was 1948. What a different time. No casual clothes. These men had gone to their jobs that day, came home, had their dinner, and put their suits on to come to their meeting. And so five or six of the members of that group walked across the stage and had little white nations in their lapels. You see, we didn't have too much literature. Bill was still writing a lot of it. And a lot of us, by word of mouth, told where the next meeting was, and, you know, and they'd say, "There's a good meeting at such a place," you know, and you would take down the information. But anyway, it was so different back then. And I listened to this meeting thrilled. I thought, everybody I heard drank like me. Now, one fellow, he said that he had been 37 times in jail. I thought, oh, dear God, straighten my back. Gee, I may be in the wrong place. But I remembered one day waking up and I was surrounded by bars. And I thought, dear God, what did I do last night? Oh, I was really mauling my brain. And then I lifted my eye, one eye at a time. I was asleep in the baby's crib. Now, well, anyway, the next fellow told about being in jail about 40 times or something. I used to talk with these fellows later. But anyway, all I had to do was think of that incident in the Safeway market, and I thought that was pretty insane. But anyway, the meeting went on, and then he announced we had visitors. They were from Westchester, and there was a man, those two men were speakers, and then a lady speaker. That was what brought me into AA, and it's why
I talk so much. I'm a woman of a few thousand words. Anyway, what she told me has stood me in great stead. I kept thinking, how do they do it? They're staying sober. How do they do it? And what she said was, we ask God to keep us away from a drink for one day at a time. She said, we turn our life and our will over to the care of God as we understand them for 24 hours. And I looked at the clock. It was 10 o'clock on a Wednesday night. And you know what I thought? I thought, tomorrow night at 10 o'clock, McGuire's will still be open. My hangout, you know. And the liquor store will still be open. So what have I got to lose? I thought, I better turn my life over to God. And I did. 10 o'clock on that Wednesday, April 14th. I said, dear God, you can have my life for the next 24 hours. And what a revelation. It was a day that I wasn't planning, you know. Whose birthday is coming up? When can I get legitimately drunk? Now, all sorts of a drink left me for the day. And what a wonderful feeling. A load was lifted off me. I remember other nights I had gotten down on my knees, saying my rosary and saying my prayers. That night, I got in and lay my head on the pillow and said, dear God, please let me have another one of those, another 24-hour period. It's amazing. It works. It really works. And, well, to tell you the truth, I immediately, well, first of all, they told me at one meeting that there was a great meeting, and it was held in the Engineers Auditorium in New York on the first Friday of every month. So they said, you really ought to go to that. Well, I asked my husband, he worked downtown, and I said, John, would you bring me to that meeting? He said, yeah, have Mom mind the kids. You come down and we'll have dinner out and I'll take you to that meeting. Did that on the first Friday of May of 1948. And when going into this huge hall, I said to him, let's go down front. He said, I haven't got the problem. We're sitting in the back. So we sat in the back. And there was a gentleman came in, tall, friendly-looking man, and came in, sat in my same row, and he took his briefcase and put it on his knees. He had long legs. And I looked at him and I said to my husband, I think this is Bill Wilson. He said, you would. It was Bill. And he got up and spoke that night. And that hall was very full, but they were all men. There were about five or six women, including me, in the whole place. But anyway, they all went up to talk to him later, whole bunches. But ladies, we stayed in one space on the left, and he spoke to each one, you know, and said a few words, and he said to me, well, are you new? I said, yeah, almost 3 weeks. And I said, he said, have you found a sponsor? Well, I told you what I was doing, asking every woman I saw. And I said, no, not yet. He said, make sure it's a woman. That was his creed. Anyway, woman to woman and man to man. That's what he thought. It so happened that at my first meeting, a lady sat next to me, and when I'm listening to these stories, you know, I turned to her. Daisy, who was the woman who spoke, she said something that made me laugh. She said, you know, a doctor told me to start drinking beer to put on weight. And she said, I've been drinking it for 20 years. And she held up an arm that was like a matchstick. It didn't work.
So I left, and I turned to this woman beside me, who was the wife of an alcoholic, and I said to her, "Does this go on all the time?" She said, "Aren't you at your first meeting?" And I said, "Yes." She said, "You sit there. I'll be back. You stay there." And she left. She was looking for the only female member of that group, but she was on a slip with the chairman. And they had taken the treasury, too. So. But anyway, that girl who was on the slip eventually came back to our group, and she became the closest thing to a sponsor that I ever had. Virginia was a slippy from the word go. She just couldn't stay sober, but she told me so much that helped me. You see, back then, we had one-on-one 12-step work. I went to my first closed meeting, and the first thing they did, well, these men were sitting around, all men, and there were about 22 of them, I'd say, and me. And they were taking all the information of the group. They take their name, address, and phone number. And when it came to me, I came up and told them that information. And then they said, "And how long have you been sober?" And I was so proud. I said, 50 days tomorrow. So the guy behind me gave me a poke in the back and said, 49, baby, 49. I said, "He's right, it's 49. At that meeting, they handed us a draft of what they called 12 principles to ensure the continuance of this program. And that was our tradition in draft form. It was worded a lot different than the traditions are now. But it said on this paper, we all had to read it, it said, "Make any changes or adjustments that you think should be there." And I have to laugh. 49 days of sobriety, I could have changed one of the traditions. But anyway, I do want to tell you that at one point I felt I owed a debt of gratitude to that priest for steering me to AA. And so I went back over to the rectory to talk to him, but the whole church was open. We had, what we don't have any longer, 40 days, 40 hours devotion, where they had the church was all open and the priests were all there. Now there's too much, you know, vandalism and everything. They can't do that anymore. But anyway, he was standing outside the church, so I went over to him and said, "Father Murray, I was going over to the rectory to thank you for sending me to AA." He said, "I did?" I said, "Yes, in confession you told me, you know, that about a man in Our Lady of Mercy." So I called the rectory. He said, "Oh, what is it like, Ruth?" So I said to him, "Well, it's quite a program, Father. We have 12 steps, but we have to first admit we're an alcoholic, that we're..." I said, "Alcoholic means we're licked by alcohol." But anyway, I went on and I said to him, "Then the second step says to restore us to sanity, we need God." And I said, "And as a matter of fact, I'm doing my fourth step now. I had it, you know, in some form from the book in my pocketbook." So I took out the slip of paper and I'm showing it. I said, "You see, Father, this was when I was 11 years old. I was self-centered, you know." He said, "This sounds like a general confession." So he said, "Let's go inside." And he brought me into the confessional, and I was there a long time. But how wonderful. That was my fourth and fifth step done. And this was... Thank you. I have done them many times since, of course. And as you go on, as they say, you get your brains back and you remember things that you just push back there. Anyway, it's such a wonderful program. When I go on retreat now, I always try to get back to the nitty-gritty, our steps, to live by them is what we are. We were given a priceless gift in this program. I honestly believe that Dr. Bob and Bill were inspired. This had been a problem for so many years. I remember looking at all those old magazines that brought Prohibition. And by the way, that's when I had my first drink. I was a teenager. I was rebellious. And they said, you can't drink. So when I was offered a drink, I took it. In fact, the word speakeasy had a romantic appeal for me. But the first drink I ever had was that we had this date. Three gals from my all-girls academy. We had a date with three fellows from the neighboring town. And they brought a big car, and they said something like, you girls drink, don't you? And they passed a bottle that night. Well, I had never drunk out of a bottle. So when I put the bottle to my lips, which of course I thought I might as well do this, it went down the neck of my dress, you know. So anyway, the night wore on, the bottle was passed a few times in the car. And then I went home. When I went home, I went to the refrigerator and took out a bottle of soda and practiced drinking out of a bottle. I got a lift out of it. Girls, I could go on forever, and I know I'm over time now. I have more time. Well, yes. Yes, thank you. See, I need coaches. You see, I told you about that 49 days of sobriety. I said I had 50. Well, the next day, they came to my door, a man from my group, and I was getting ready to take the children to the doctors that day. So I was getting dressed. And I had something that was brand new in 1948, a zipper in the back of my dress. And I got it up part way, you know, but I'm holding it when I went to the door. And it was Pat, and he said to me, hello, Ruth, how are you? And I said, good. He said, are you sober? I said, 50 days today. So he said, I have a 12-step call for you. So I said, oh, Pat, I was getting kids to the doctor, but I'll call him and I'll call my neighbor. I called my neighbor in to mind the kids. I said, I'll go with you just a minute. You'll have to zipper me. And I turned around. Pat was about six. 6'6". So he lifted me 2 feet off the floor. But then he amazed me, because this 12-step call was a woman I knew. She lived only a block and a half from me, and we were walking to her house. And he said to me, I think she's pretty sick. She may need the hospital. He said, if she does, I'll have to borrow a car. So I said, well, then I'll go to the door. He said, oh, yeah, you have to. He said, I need a woman to go into to see her. So I, you know, walking over there, I was thinking, good Lord, the whole of the Bronx is going to know Ruth is an alcoholic. But I thought, it's part of it. I have to face it. So I went to her door and knocked on it, and her teenage son came out. She had a huge family, and the youngest one was in the kindergarten that I was sending my son to. The oldest boy of mine. But anyway, I knew her from church. I knew her from everything. So I said to Kevin, I said, I'd like to see your mother, Kevin. And he said, oh, you can't, Mrs. Megan. I said, she's sick, isn't she? He said, yeah. I said, I have that same illness. I'm an alcoholic. Well, when I said it, I thought the world stopped for an instant. It was like 2 o'clock on a sunny afternoon on the street near my home. But you see, I had been saying it at meetings at night and thinking it, but this was vivid. So I then went in to see, let me in to see Mary, and she was very ill. She recognized me, and she said, I'm in a bad way. But anyway, I said, well, we're suggesting that you go to Knickerbocker Hospital. That's where Dr. Silkworth and his wonderful nurse, Teddy Rowan, had held sway. They also had started that in 1946. It was a 5-day stay in Knickerbocker Hospital. They had one floor, and on one end was the men, and on the other was the women. Later on, they had a room like in the middle they called Duffy's Tavern. But at any rate, in those days, you had to go with your patients, you know, like I was taking Mary, and Pat did, he borrowed someone's car, but he took us down to Knickerbocker Hospital, and she had to have $75 for the 5 days. The thing about 12-step work then was that you had to explain. I had to explain to her family this whole program, because when people were put into hospitals for drinking, they were thrown into Bellevue or into city hospitals, and people wouldn't touch them with a 10-foot pole. Drunks. You know, so this was new. I had to explain to them, she will be treated as if she has a disease. Now, you know, we were the only ones who thought we had a disease for quite a while before the American Medical Association finally said, yes, we did. But at any rate, that first day, 50 days of sobriety, that was my first 12-step call. And what you had to do was wait for your patient to be admitted. And in that time, you just paced the floor there. You knew that everyone you met on that floor was in AA. You were sponsoring people. So I was going up to people saying, my name is Ruth, what's yours? You know? And I came up to this man and I said, my name is Ruth, what's yours? And he took both my hands in his and looked down into my eyes. He said, Silkworth. And he said, how long have you been sober? And I said, 50 days. I was so grateful for those 50 days. So he said to me, that's a wonderful beginning. And he and I became very good friends. As a matter of fact, a few years later, I guess it was about 2 or 3 years later, Colonel Towns of Towns Hospital invited a group of us alcoholics to his home. And he was a sort of a social guy. He had lovely little tea sandwiches and coffee and tea for us, you know. And there were about 30 of us, men and women. And he said, what I'd like to do is form a committee. When people come to my hospital, I'll say to them, are you interested in this program called Alcoholics Anonymous? And if they are, I'll put them on a certain floor. And I'd like you people to take each day of the week, a man and a woman, to come and visit these people. So we all offered, and I offered to go on Monday. And this gentleman offered to go on Monday, too, and he came over to me and he said, what time do you think you'll be going next Monday? I said to him, well, like 2:30. I said, you don't have to come when I do. I said, you just visit the men and I'll visit. He said, I want to go when you're there. So a few days, I went down that Monday. I still didn't know who this gentleman was, but he was asking me, he said, what do you think I should say to these fellows? I said, maybe they don't know how they got here. they may wonder what happened. I'm in Towns Hospital. I said, you just start from there. I said, tell them about yourself. Bring one piece of AA literature and just tell about yourself. I said, oh, thank you for the tip. And then we went our ways. And a list of that committee came to the house through the mail the next day. And here I see I'm talking to a well-known surgeon in New York and telling him what to tell the guy. But when you're in AA and doing 12-step work, you think you know everything. I guess I'd speak to anybody about AA. But anyway, Dr. Silkworth had that little office, you know, and I had so many one-on-one 12-step calls, women. As a matter of fact, the gal who worked in the New York intergroup, she spoke in Florida not long ago, and I went up to her and I said, you pulled a dirty trick on me. You changed your last name. She said, what about Ruth Mangan? You changed your last name, too. I said, oh, yeah. But anyway, she said, Ruth, I remember you because I had your name and phone number under my phone. And she said, I had there. Any woman in the Bronx, call this. No wonder I was out every day. You know, cold weather, I'd have to put leggings on the kids. They came with me. As a matter of fact, Tony got many a jar of guppies and presents that I could have thrown out, you know. Anyway, it was terrific, that one-on-one facing the gal. I'll never forget it. And then when the American Medical Association said we had a disease, that's when all the rehab started. And that was sort of outlawed, that kind of 12-step work. I missed it. As a matter of fact, on my 5th anniversary in New York, I was leaving New York and moving to Jersey, back to my old home. And that AA group was so kind to me. I had these two fellows who lived in the Salvation Army near us and they used to attend our meetings. Well, when I'd have a roast or something, I'd invite them, and they enjoyed us being with the family, you know. But they were very kind to me, too. They took the two older boys to the circus and the rodeo. But anyway, when I was celebrating the 5th anniversary and saying farewell, one of them hired a 4-piece orchestra for my anniversary. And the other one got corsages for all the ladies. So I had invited everybody in my building. It was a Sunday evening that I was celebrating, and a lot of those gals needed it, too. But anyway, it was a wonderful occasion, and 9 months later, I had another son. Anyway, that was a bang-up deal. I have to tell you, girls, you did me the world of good tonight. I love you all. It's wonderful. We have such a bond. It doesn't matter, you know, our circumstances. Thank God. Thank God for this day. Thank you all for listening.